Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How has the United States anti-terrorism strategy changed since the devastating events of 9/11? And how did our evolving efforts play into last spring's successful raid on the bin Laden compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan? U.S. authorities have responded in kind as terrorist networks have grown more technologically sophisticated over the past decade, and they have also changed their thinking on the most effective ways to predict, understand, and interrupt the activities of terrorist cells. Joining us to talk about it is New York Times Pentagon correspondent Tom Shanker, who, along with the paper's terrorism correspondent Eric Schmidt, is the author of the new book Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Tom, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. I pass through Dallas a lot. I have family in Oklahoma, and I'm at the military bases in Texas regularly, so I listen to your show, and it's a real honor to be invited on today. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. The feeling is mutual. After 9/11, initially, the focus of U.S. efforts was, in many ways, a very traditional sort of military heavy force campaign intended to overwhelm the enemy. At what point did leaders have to acknowledge, if nothing else behind closed doors, that this was not working?
Well, that's exactly right. President Bush, in the horrible, terrifying days after 9/11, ordered a pretty straight military intelligence campaign of capture and kill, run all the bad guys to ground. But it wasn't even more than a year and a half or two before Donald Rumsfeld, in particular, saw that this strategy was actually at risk of creating more jihadi and militants than it was taking off the battlefield, because it was brute force and clumsy. And so he, among others, began calling for a more nuanced and sophisticated strategy to move ahead in counterterrorism.
And initially, the assumption was that because the world had changed so much since the Cold War, the deterrent strategies that we had developed to keep the Soviets at bay would not apply in any way here.
Well, and there was certainly a powerful argument for that. Deterrence requires you to know who the adversary is, where the adversary's military forces are, what valuable assets the adversary holds that you can put at risk. We certainly knew with the Soviet Union, or China as the case may be, if they launched missiles or sent off bombers, we could track them in our radars with certainty, and we could hold their missile fields and their leadership sites and their government buildings at risk. None of those apply to stateless terrorists. Who could actually launch an attack without leaving any real fingerprints, certainly not a return address.
So I'm going to talk, or we're going to talk in a minute, about how folks got together in the Pentagon to start brainstorming about different ideas. But first, would you characterize the working relationships that existed between the military and civilian intelligence services before they were thrown together by 9/11?
Well, it's not just the military intelligence. It was law enforcement as well. Mm-hmm. And to say that it was a dysfunctional family of national security folks would be polite. They didn't trust each other. They didn't share. They guarded their information. So it really was, in many ways, 9/11 was not, you know, made possible, but was sort of enabled by the fact that people were not sharing information and could not work together very well. And that is certainly one of the most significant changes over the past 10 years, Chris.
So they all got together in the Pentagon, and talk about those early discussions and the kinds of ideas that were thrown around.
Well, there was a small group of sort of, somewhat eccentric, somewhat interesting, somewhat worldly thinkers inside the Pentagon and at some of the military commands who sort of, you know, back to the future, they said, look, if Cold War deterrence kept a tense but somewhat trustworthy nuclear peace with this horrible adversary, the Soviet Union, for all those decades, might there be elements that we can apply to terrorism? And they realized that maybe you couldn't identify real assets to hold at risk, but terrorists have a lot of virtual territory. They have the safe haven of the internet. They actually need money. They need property. They need weapons and all of that. And one interesting thing they found was that the most important thing that terror leaders hold, their most valuable asset, is their reputation. So the thinking began to emerge, okay, let's not target Soviet missile silos like in the Cold War, but how do we target the reputations of these leaders? How do we make them think that their reputations will suffer if they behave in certain ways? And if you can alter their behavior to your benefit, Chris, that's the classic definition of deterrence, because you're deterring action by altering your enemy's thinking.
And you alter their thinking in part by going after not necessarily only those top-level leaders, but the second-tier support system.
Right. Once a suicide bomber straps on a vest, they're beyond reaching. Mm-hmm. And someone like a bin Laden or a Zawahiri, they are so committed to the cause that they certainly can't be deterred. But the terror operation to really function effectively requires a whole network. Like we spoke about a minute ago, you need money, you need safe houses, you need weapons. And the people who run those parts of the terror organization are probably not so willing to give up their lives to the cause. They like their standard of living. So if you can deter the action of the money launderers, if you can take out the weapon suppliers, who are really just dealing in black market weapons and sell to criminals as well as terrorists, but if you can say to them, hey, Mr. Financier, hey, Mr. Gunrunner, hey, Mr. Realtor who rents the safe house, if you continue working with these terror cells, you will suffer, your family will suffer, your quality of life will end. And that actually deterred a lot of terrorist acts by taking out those mid-level people in the terror network. And it means you don't have to try and kill everybody, which is impossible and, in fact, is counterproductive.
So, Tom, what do they learn about the best ways to take these support employees, essentially, out of action? Do you arrest them? Do you kill them? Do you pay them off?
Well, there's several ways. One of our case studies talks about the Hawala networks in Afghanistan and Pakistan, as I'm sure your listeners know. Hawala is the money transfer system used in the Middle East. It's based on trust. You walk into a Hawala center in one city, you pay them money, you sign your name on a piece of paper, you shake hands. That Hawala operator simply calls one of his colleagues in the other city and says, expect a visit tomorrow from Mr. So-and-so. Please give him this much money. I have it here. You and I will take out the fees. I guarantee I'll pay you later. And the Hawalas in particular in eastern Afghanistan and the tribal areas of Pakistan were a major source of revenue for the terror cells operating there. The military in 09 in particular took out a lot of the Hawala operators. As you said, Chris, they were arrested, they were killed. But they realized these Hawala houses have 20, 30, 40 families operating there. You simply wouldn't want to. It would be wrong to kill all of them. So what they did, they went family to family to family and said, we know that this percent of your business is funding terrorist activities. If you continue to do that, you will be arrested, your sons will be arrested, your wives and children will have no livelihood, and this lovely standard of living you have built by your legitimate money lending operation will be over. Stop dealing with terror cells. And most of them did, and so truly, those threats deterred their action, and they dried up terror funding in the area.
Well, and that brings us to another really important point that gets overlooked often, I think, which is that there are people involved in these networks who don't necessarily have passionate political and ideological beliefs. They're just trying to make a living. And I'm not justifying their activities, which are illegal, but it's not always about wanting to sort of take down the United States.
That's exactly right. And those are the people that you really want to get to. And in many cases, the terror facilitators are just as happy to work with a criminal gang as they are with terrorists. And, you know, we certainly don't want to condone crime in the Islamic world, but as far as American national security interests, if those people are going to run guns, if they're going to rent flop houses to bad guys, better to rent them to criminals than those who are planning mass casualty terror attacks. And it goes to this whole concept that, you know, dating from Vietnam and through this war on terror, this campaign against violent extremism, a lot of people have talked about how if only we could win the hearts and minds of the Muslim world, the war would be over. Well, Chris, that's just crazy. Think all of your listeners. What if somebody said to them, hey, you know, the Muslim world wants to win your heart and mind. They would say, you know, it's my heart, it's my mind. I don't want to be influenced that way. Well, America needs to be just as sophisticated in understanding that Muslims may not want to think like us or love us. And you know what? That's okay. All we want to do is have a trustworthy relationship with people who do not seek to do us harm. And sort of that live and let live attitude is behind a lot of the new counterterrorism thinking.
Talk about this, though. Does this second-tier deterrence strategy, Tom, explain why there are people who object to finding people in Guantanamo Bay and other military prisons, both run by the U.S. and run by our allies in other countries? They'll find people in these places and say, well, this individual was not directly involved, is not a high-ranking person, and yet the U.S. continues to detain them as a suspect. Is this the majority of the people we're talking about? that, or are they targeted by this sort of effort?
Well, I think the Guantanamo question, as I'm, you know, as has been discussed so often, is today a political question. I mean, there may be a group of truly hardcore, dangerous people at Guantanamo, the completely irreconcilable adversaries of the U.S., you know, who probably need to be locked up for a very, very long time. But without a doubt, and government officials say this, a lot of those at Guantanamo are probably not a major risk to the United States. The problem is, what do you do with them? Mm-hmm. You can't repatriate them to their home countries. You can't repatriate them to a third country that doesn't want them. Sometimes the countries where they would end up would treat them even worse than they're being treated here. And you certainly can't do a habeas corpus here in the U.S. So, you know, late in the Bush administration, when Secretary Gates became Defense Secretary, he was among the first to say, hey, I'm a former CIA director. Whatever intelligence these Gitmo detainees have has expired by now. We should close Guantanamo. And that started a process that President Obama certainly made one of his campaign planks in his platform. Unfortunately, politics and the iron law that a new prison has to be in somebody's congressional district has meant that Guantanamo still has not been closed.
What was it like? What did it take to sell the new strategy that was developed around 2005 to President Bush?
Well, President Bush in particular was very skeptical. And in fact, we report inside one of his summer cabinet meetings held at his ranch there in West Texas, in which Rumsfeld and a couple of others came down and briefed him on the concept of new deterrence thinking as applied to terrorism. And Chris Bush just didn't buy it. I mean, putting aside all the rhetoric of dead or alive, with us or against us, Bush really viewed himself as a war president, as a war on terror president. He was not going to be the new deterrence president. That just didn't, you know, fit with his thinking of himself or how he thought the war on terror should be fought. Rumsfeld explained it. The aides explained it. And interestingly enough, another person around the table at the Bush Ranch in Crawford was General James Cartwright, who at the time was commander of the military strategic command in Omaha. And the strategic command owns the crown jewels of America's nuclear force, the missiles and the bombers and the submarines. So General Cartwright, of course, was versed in classic deterrence. And as one of the military's smartest minds, he also had independently been working on the new deterrence. And so Bush turned to him and said, Hoss Cartwright, tell me, what do you think about this stuff? And Cartwright surprised the president by saying, you know, Mr. President, there's a lot here. There's a lot we should be thinking about. And he made the case to Bush in ways that Bush could understand. President Bush was a leading advocate of missile defense against North Korea, against Iran, even acknowledging that an American missile defense program couldn't shoot down all of, you know, an adversary's missiles. Mm-hmm. But that's not what missile defense is about. Missile defense is about shooting down enough of the bad guy's missiles that he thinks twice before launching an attack because he knows you'll be able to retaliate. And so Cartwright said to Bush, if you feel that an imperfect missile defense system creates uncertainty in the mind of North Korea or Iran and may deter an attack, how can you not believe that applying tools of deterrence to terror leaders and making them uncertain whether they'll be successful, whether they'll look foolish, whether they'll be caught, how can you say that isn't just as effective? And Cartwright made a rather brilliant argument for the new deterrence.
Tom Shanker is with us. He's Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times and has been embedded multiple times with U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. His new book, written along with New York Times terrorism correspondent Eric Smith, is called Counterstrike: The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. You can be part of this conversation by calling in now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tom Shanker. He's Pentagon correspondent for The New York Times and author of the new book, Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about this fascinating nugget in the book, Tom. We've all heard the adage over and over that you never negotiate with terrorists. However, after 9/11, there were efforts to communicate after a fashion with Osama bin Laden. Those were ultimately unsuccessful, but can you talk about what made U.S. intelligence officials believe it was at least worth a try?
Sure. You're obviously a very careful reader of the book. That's one of the needles in the haystack that we hid for the readers. It was really interesting, as you said so correctly, Chris. American policy, Israel, Britain, is never to negotiate with terrorists. But after 9/11, terrorism had taken on really a whole new capability. The mass casualty attack, the complicated four-way attack that was planned on 9/11, said to the Bush administration that we're dealing with a new kind of enemy, particularly one that if it got hold of weapons of mass destruction, could perhaps be a threat to America of a way that terrorists never could before. And so the intelligence community very secretly began trying to reach out to bin Laden. They used family members, members of his large and extended family from Saudi Arabia, some of whom were very helpful in passing on messages because they too wanted their kinsmen held back, and others, of course, were very antagonistic. Messages were sent through his vast business empire, and while we don't know exactly what they said, it was an attempt to set up some sort of a dialogue establishing red lines. Because, again, if you think about the Cold War analogy, you know, the Soviet Union was not only a nuclear superpower, but it was also a huge criminal enterprise, and at the same time was really a terrorist organization, the way it treated its own population, the way it worked around the world. And so the Bush administration or part of the intelligence community thought it was at least worth trying to get some message to bin Laden to see if he or his top captains would engage in some sort of a dialogue laying out rules of a relationship and also describing the terrible reprisals that would happen for a future attack. The answer, though, from al-Qaeda senior leadership and from bin Laden was total silence.
What sort of records does al-Qaeda keep of its operations and the people with whom it works?
Well, one of our sources in the intelligence community says that al-Qaeda is much like Nazi Germany. They are completely scrupulous about keeping records. And this has really presented a lot of opportunities for intelligence. As all of your listeners know, after the raid on May 2nd that killed bin Laden, they scooped up all kinds of computers and hard drives and all of that. But there were also a series of raids across the Middle East, and one in particular in Sinjar, Iraq. This was a smuggling center along the Syrian border that a lot of the suicide jihadis were coming in. A special operations raid hit Sinjar and gathered up enough files that they became known as the al-Qaeda Rolodex, and they were completely detail-oriented. All of the suicide bombers who'd come into Iraq to make war against the Americans and the allies and the Iraqi government, they had their hometown, they had their birth dates, they had their family members and cell phone numbers, and it really allowed the U.S. intelligence community to build a map of where all the suicide bombers were coming from, something that would have been impossible if al-Qaeda was not so anal about its record keeping.
Were these things like deeply encrypted, or were you just able to take a thumb drive and pop it into your USB and suddenly have this list of contacts?
In this case, it was like your address book in your email or on your cell phone. It literally had, you know, the name, all of the aliases that the militant was using, where he had been recruited, who recruited him, what he had done professionally. It even listed what they wanted to do. And a surprising number said they actually wanted to be suicide bombers, although some of them, of course, said they wanted to come in just to fight the Americans.
How are the different branches of al-Qaeda using the Internet these days to communicate with one another and with potential recruits?
Well, particularly since the death of bin Laden and, you know, not the demise of al-Qaeda senior leadership, but it's clearly been knocked on its heels. The other franchises really have taken to the Internet as truly their safe haven. It's where they recruit. It's where they propagandize. Where they raise money, and it's also where they send out operational commands. We have several case studies about the very clever but frightening ways in which the terror franchises use the internet to send out operational battle orders. And one of them that I have a couple of teenage sons that any parent has to wonder about, because the American intelligence community has very sophisticated surveillance systems that pick up on keywords, whether used in cell phones or emails, terrorists have learned to hide their conversations during online gaming sessions with the Xbox or the Wii, because you know these internet games that can link from a handful to hundreds of people around the world, the language of these internet PlayStation games sounds very much like combat. Most of them are combat games. So jihadis can, at a prearranged time, go into one of these game sites, conduct all of their terror business, but to the outside listener and to the sensitive eavesdropping machine, they sound like they're simply gamers.
Yeah, and there's such a vast flood of information that it would be hard to tell a serious threat from two 16-year-old boys from across the country.
That's exactly right, and the terrorists learn this because if you're having a cell phone conversation from the tribal areas of Pakistan, not very many people there are going to be talking about bombings and that sort of thing. But as you said, 16-year-olds playing their Wii games, it's all about shooting them up.
So what have we learned about sending decoy messages?
Well, the American government has a lot of ways to get into and put at risk the terror safe haven of the internet. One is that the intelligence community has learned how to forge the Al-Qaeda watermarks or certification seals of their online postings. Al-Qaeda, like any business enterprise, wants its official communications to be official and for people to follow them and to trust them. But the American intelligence community can go online and post things that look like the real thing, but are kind of confusing and contradictory and throw into doubt the leadership's orders, and that disrupts what the terrorists might do. And another more subtle way is that there are a lot of jihadi chat rooms. The American government has hired fluent Arabic speakers to go into these chat rooms sort of to raise questions, sort of the, oh, brothers, help me understand. How could the Al-Qaeda bombing of a wedding party at a hotel in Amman, Jordan, that killed so many Islamic people, how can that be a righteous cause? Can somebody help explain that to me? And so they try to foment a discussion among potential terrorist wannabes to hope that they will reconsider their actions.
Tom, can you talk about how U.S. officials make the call as to how long to sit and observe and even participate in these conversations, how long to let them go when they think there might be a physical threat in the works?
Well, that's a great question. And some of the most fervent and robust, and those are code words for angry, discussions the government has pitted the military against the intelligence community, against the law enforcement community over that exact question, Chris. What happens is the law enforcement and intelligence community like to monitor these jihadi websites. They can see what people are talking about. They can see who comes and who goes. And even the masterfully encrypted ones, believe me, U.S. computers are even bigger and smarter and faster, so they can get inside of them. They want to leave these sites up so that they can learn about an organization, perhaps move up the chain of command and track some of the leaders. But the military, as you can imagine, especially in Iraq and Afghanistan, if they see a jihadi website fomenting actions that are a clear and present and immediate danger to the troops or to civilians, they want the site taken down.
How do they find these sites? I mean, is it as simple as if you speak Arabic, you can do a sort of Google search and find the sort of sites where real live jihadis are communicating?
Unfortunately, it's just that easy. And like any research project, you'll start at the margins and work your way in. But there are a lot of English-language jihadi websites. In fact, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which is probably the most dangerous affiliate today, is run by Anwar al-Awlaki.
From New Mexico, right?
From New Mexico. Yeah. And a lot of his propaganda, Chris, is in English. He has a magazine that comes out every quarter in English, a beautiful four-color magazine with recipes for explosives and poisons and urging jihad. So unfortunately, you don't even have to be an Arabic speaker to pretty quickly find some pretty dangerous stuff.
Well, and what's so chilling about that recruitment is thinking back to, we just had Lawrence Wright on the show last week.
Oh, yes, of course.
And in his book, he talks about the fact that 9/11 almost didn't happen because they couldn't find any qualified volunteers mm-hmm. who would blend in well enough in the West to get on these planes and to do these attacks. And then at the last minute, they found people. But if you have someone who was born and raised in this country, they're going to have a lot fewer problems traveling without raising suspicion.
That's exactly right. And what's happening as well, you know, if one were to look at the future of terrorism today, while it may be true that Al-Qaeda's senior leadership in Pakistan is not quite as potent, these other affiliates truly are, you know, the up-and-comers. And even more so, they have learned to try to inspire the individual lone wolf terrorist, like those who've taken machine guns at, you know, a military base there in Texas, mm-hmm. a car bomb in Times Square, the underwear bomber. And the individual self-radicalized terrorist is almost impossible to find until he or she has acted. And an Alaki or Zawahiri may not even know what that person is doing. And in fact, they even say, if you want to be a jihadi and if you're smart enough and clever enough, you should mount your own attack with this goal and don't even tell us. And that way nobody will find you until it's too late. And that's a rather terrifying proposition as we look to the years ahead.
And even in these situations when would-be attackers are not entirely successful, you know, you think the shoe bomber and the underwear bomber and the guy in Times Square, they don't really have to succeed in detonating a target to get what they want. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Even though there has not been a mass casualty terror attack since 9/11, even the close calls have been viewed as success by the terrorists. A perfect example are the printer cartridges that were sent by Al-Qaeda in Yemen aboard commercial cargo carriers. They were found before they exploded. No planes went down. Nobody died. But the aircraft and airline industry was forced to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in security measures. Hmm. Cargo was slowed down. The economy was hurt. And the printer cartridge attack cost only $4,500 to mount. So even though nobody died, Alaki went on the Internet saying that that was a masterful success because of the huge reaction that it provoked.
What's to stop Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations from posting their own decoy information on these sites that they suspect U.S. officials might be monitoring?
You know, there's probably in any spy versus spy, terror versus counterterrorism, I'm sure a lot of that is going on, Chris. And terrorism is really the new sort of Darwinism, if you will. Mm. Both sides are evolving and changing. I was in Afghanistan just 2 weeks ago talking to some of the teams that counter the IEDs, the improvised roadside explosives that are the leading killer of American troops. And they say that the IED designs change every 14 days. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean they change the explosives, but they change the wiring. They change the signaling because they know that the United States technology is fast enough that when they find a new IED, they can come up with countermeasures in a week or so. So they change every 2 weeks. So whether it's IEDs buried in Afghanistan or messages posted online, there is a lot of gamesmanship and plotting going on.
Yeah, it's like trying to keep up with the way the flu mutates over a season.
That's a perfect example, and they are both viruses. You're exactly right.
So I wanted to leave time at the end of this hour, Tom, to talk about, at the very end of the book, you give us this sort of bonus chapter with the best account I have read of the intricate details of how the raid on the bin Laden compound in Abbottabad went down. So let's talk about this. At what point did U.S. officials become confident that this guy they had spotted walking around the grounds of a house in Abbottabad was probably Osama bin Laden?
Right. Well, even the night before the raid, Chris, most officials gave it only a 50-50 chance. That being said, right after the first of the year or into this past spring, intelligence officers began to see enough evidence and enough of what they call pattern of life to indicate there was certainly a high-value target there. And when they got the satellite images of this man they called the Pacer, a very tall man who never left the compound, a lot of people began saying, this is high-value target number one. We have to move forward with the mission. And just as the U.S. has learned a lot about counterterrorism, bin Laden had learned a lot about counterterrorism. His aides who came to visit not only turned off their cell phones, Chris, they actually removed the SIM card miles before they got to the compound. There was no internet line in, no telephone. So he really had learned to shrink his footprint to be almost invisible.
Was that in itself a red flag that in a wealthy neighborhood in one of the more modern cities in Pakistan, you had a house with no communications technology?
It certainly was. And the other thing was that he burned all of his garbage inside the compound rather than putting it outside at the street. However, one of the counterarguments, and, you know, this isn't to be ironic at all, but there were those who said that the same pattern of behavior could be of a very wealthy businessman, even perhaps a member of one of the Gulf royal families, and this was his weekend retreat to meet his mistress, because you would follow a similar behavior pattern. That being said, I think the extreme security measures are what led President Obama to go ahead and order the raid that began on May 1st, ended on May 2nd.
What's interesting, though, is you describe these extreme security measures. There was not a phalanx of guards at the gate. In some ways, it was a very unassuming presence within the neighborhood.
I think that was probably a conscious decision. Early on, when he fled the Tora Bora region of Afghanistan in December of 01, bin Laden was certainly with a phalanx of security. But I think one of the conscious decisions he made was that if there was a heavy security presence at his compound in Abbottabad, which is really a very upper middle class sort of not resort but retirement community, that might have attracted a lot of attention. So I think he made a conscious security decision to place his trust not in big guys with guns, but in the absence of any overt sign that somebody inside was important.
Do we think now that he had been there since 01?
There was a lot of intelligence that hinted perhaps he was going to come back to Afghanistan to bless a major jihadi council to launch a new round of mass casualty attacks, maybe 06 or 07. He certainly never showed up, but I think there was a lot of intelligence that showed he had planned to go there. But now people are fairly certain he'd been in Abbottabad for several years.
We'll talk more about the raid in just a moment. My guest this hour is Tom Shanker, Pentagon correspondent for The New York Times, who's been embedded multiple times with U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is the co-author, together with Eric Schmidt of The New York Times, of the new book Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. If you'd like to ask a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times Pentagon correspondent Tom Shanker. His new book is called Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. So, Tom, they think they know that this is, in fact, bin Laden in this compound in Abbottabad. There are U.S. security, or rather intelligence officials, posted nearby in a rented house. What were they able to know based on the technology they had about what was going on within that house and what the layout was and all of that?
Right. They set up this safe house to observe. In many ways, it was to establish a pattern of life, who came and who went and how often. There's also some thought that they might have been able to stroll the area around the house without being observed, carrying what are called ground-penetrating radar, or perhaps to have driven a truck on the roads around the house, because they wanted to make sure there were not any escape tunnels, because if they were to drop in at night and bin Laden could get out through some tunnel, well, of course, they wanted to know about that in advance. There's also a report that they sent a doctor door-to-door, not just there, but through the entire community with immunizations for kids. They were hoping, if possible, to get some DNA off the children to perhaps find out for sure whether bin Laden's family was in the area, which, of course, would have given them higher confidence.
So they start to plan the raid. What kind of practice do you do for something like this?
Well, it's something they'd done several times before. There was, in fact, right after 9/11, when some of the al-Qaeda leaders were hiding in Iran, there was actually preparations for a mission to send a commando team into Iran to capture those guys. And for that, they did mock invasions along the Gulf Coast, perhaps even in your lovely state of Texas. And so likewise here, they set up two mock architectures of the bin Laden compound. Mm. And they practiced for several weeks going over walls, landing helicopters, because, again, they were hoping that practice would make perfect. And what's interesting, satellite technology is now so good that they were able to build these mock compounds to an incredibly accurate scale, including, like, you know, where there were indentations in the ground and where the garbage was and all that sort of stuff.
Obviously, they also planned for contingencies if things should go wrong. And in fact, something did go wrong. One of the helicopters, when they were landing, actually crashed into a wall.
Well, what happens, helicopters are loaded with fuel and people, and very precise calculations are made based on the thickness of the air, because helicopters, of course, don't so much fly as beat the air into submission wherever they're going. And because it was about, you know, a dozen or more degrees hotter that night than they had anticipated, the air was very different. The pilot couldn't control the stealth Black Hawk, and it did crash land inside the compound, which made them scramble and change the mission. But these are the things, Chris, that they planned for. We write in our book that there was this 3-inch-thick bound document they called the Playbook, which had Plan A, Plan B, Plan B1, all the branches and sequels for if they got bin Laden alive, if they had to kill him, what would happen if Pakistani police showed up on the scene. They had the lawyers standing by. So, again, it goes back to what Eisenhower said before the D-Day invasion. It's not so much the plan, it's the planning that's important. And even when they lost this helicopter, they had enough practice and backup plans that they were able to execute the mission successfully.
Why a raid with 73 people attached, which is still a greater risk to American life than, say, a drone attack?
Right. A drone attack might have obliterated the man they called the Pacer, removing forever a chance to get the DNA to prove that bin Laden was dead. Hmm. There was also a discussion about sending in B-2 stealth bombers. But when they did the calculations of what they'd have to drop, it would have been impossible to take out the compound without killing innocent Pakistanis living across the street and nearby. So at the end of the day, President Obama decided to send in what was, you're right, Chris, a large but still much more precise strike team than would have been possible with a bombing mission.
We'll go to the phones now. We have on the line in Arlington, Sajjad. Hi, Sajjad.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, yes, I'm from Pakistan and live right here in Arlington. I was watching interview of Benazir Bhutto that was done in a program like Frost Over the World, and that was in 2007. And at that time, she revealed that Osama bin Laden was killed by Omar Sheikh in 2005. So if he was killed in 2005, according to her interview, who was killed in May? Did you done some research on that, or do you have any comments about that?
Sure. I'm not familiar with Mrs. Bhutto's interview that you're citing, although I'm certain you're citing it correctly. All I can say is that either she misspoke, she was misquoted, or she was misinformed, because even al-Qaeda itself, on its official website, Mr. Zawahiri has confirmed that the man who was killed at Abbottabad on May 2nd was Osama bin Laden.
There have, of course, been a lot of civilian analysts, particularly in our profession, Tom, who said until 2011, perhaps he had been dead for some time. Was that speculation ever taken seriously within the U.S. government?
It was never taken seriously, because had he really died, either of natural causes or killed in an attack, al-Qaeda would eventually have to announce it, because they needed to have a formal succession process, just like any other corporation. This one, of course, very evil. But you want to have a firm leadership that is firmly in control. and rumors of bin Laden dead, unconfirmed, unacknowledged, actually would not have helped jihadi discipline within the organization. Which is so fascinating, Chris, is all of the misperceptions that bin Laden, you know, was hooked to a dialysis all these years. I mean, there was just a lot of wrong reports about a man who had been the most elusive in world history.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Jeep in Highland Village. Hi, Jeep.
Hi. Mike, I've got a question. I know it comes up often how reporters and what they report and how that affects the troops in the field, so to speak. And the title of the book, if I remember correctly, somehow deals with the secrets of our counterterrorism efforts. And is what is reported or what you've written in your book, is it in any way negatively affecting the counterterrorism efforts as they keep going on, as we keep going through this process?
Right. I mean, that's a very fair question. Thanks for asking. Reporters who cover national security, whether at the local level or national or global, always have to balance the public's right to know. Because, Jeep, it's, you know, you are a taxpayer. You are a voter. How can you make the best decisions about how your money is spent and what the nation does in your name unless you're well informed? At the same time, a frivolous disclosure of classified information, especially the kind that might put a mission at risk or American lives at risk, is something that we don't do at the New York Times. So while there are certainly a lot of sensitive issues discussed in our book, Counterstrike, we feel they are important to help you become a better informed citizen so you can, you know, vote more wisely, so you can feel better about paying your taxes. And the rule that we used, and we discussed this a lot with our military sources, both and civilian sources, is while we can describe a mission and its goal and how it went out, what we don't do is disclose names of those who carry out the missions, nor do we disclose what the military calls TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures. We don't describe TTPs in such detail that an adversary might figure out ways to counter them. So we are very comfortable that a good public discussion of important decisions is included in our book, but not in a way that will put at jeopardy these missions. And all I can say is that, you know, when your nation goes to war in your name, that is the gravest decision a democracy can make. And you and all of Chris's listeners today need to be as well informed as possible.
I want to talk a little bit about the intelligence yielded from the compound itself, including dozens of CD-ROMs and, I guess, 100 stick drives filled with information. In the end, is that data likely to be even more important than taking out the leader of al-Qaeda as a human being?
Well, there was a lot of hope that this trove would point to immediate missions, and while there were, we were told, some arrests and some raids that were mounted, because of the time lag to get information to bin Laden, there was not anything immediately actionable in that trove of data. What it did help, and this is important, it gave a lot of insight into the long-term goals of al-Qaeda. Like, for example, with the improvements of airline safety, they are beginning to look at attacks on the railroads. Because if you think about it, if you can derail a high-speed train, say, in the Washington-New York corridor, you could potentially have even higher fatalities than if you bring down an airliner. And the train system, unfortunately, is not quite as secure as the airlines if you don't go through the same checks. So, Chris, there are a lot of insights like that that are very important, but we have not learned yet of anything that was immediately actionable that was found.
So do you think that it is more likely in the near future that we will have a major attack carried out or something smaller by one of these, you know, individuals that might in fact be a rogue actor but feel ideologically affiliated with al-Qaeda?
Right. I think America faces sort of a three-headed threat right now. Al-Qaeda Central in Pakistan would still love to pull off a mass casualty attack with weapons of mass destruction. But they are less capable of doing that. The affiliates are very potent, and in fact, al-Qaeda in Yemen is trying to develop ricin, a very powerful poison, that it could wrap around bombs to explode, say, in a closed area like a movie theater or an airport lobby or something like that. And then the third head of this hydra is, just as you said, Chris, the lone wolf self-radicalized. I think, in general, Al-Qaeda is looking at smaller attacks that have a higher rate of execution and perhaps a higher chance of success, even if not mass casualty. The metaphor we use in the book is they're trying to throw pebbles into the cogs of the American economy. And if you throw enough pebbles, one of them is bound to get through. And the success of the 10 years since 9/11 is that there has not been another mass casualty attack. And the U.S. military, intelligence, law enforcement community have put off the day of that next attack and perhaps made the next attack less deadly. But everybody thinks another attack is coming.
I'm asking you an impossible question here, Tom, but how do we know when we're done with the war on terror?
Well, unfortunately, it's never going to be done. Even though on the day that bin Laden was killed, there was, you know, dancing in Times Square and at Ground Zero in scenes that looked a little bit like VE Day, you know, the sailor kissing the nurse on Times Square in 1945, there's not going to be a wall coming down. There's not going to be a peace treaty signed with Al-Qaeda. So the goal is to push down the threat level to the place where it's a constant worry but is not debilitating. And the key answer to that, Chris, is Americans need to learn to be resilient and to be a little less fraught with fear, to be wary and to be vigilant, but to be able to respond and spring back after the next attack and to not lose the sense of the great American values that we have as we pursue the terrorist threat.
So we need to take some cues from our friends in Great Britain, you think?
That's exactly right, the way the British and the Israelis respond. Remember, after the subway attacks in Britain, people were back on trains that afternoon. I guarantee if there's a subway attack in Washington, they'll be shut down for days. That only adds to the terrorist victory.
When you're interviewing sources within the government, how much disagreement do you find from one expert to the next? And what do you do to balance that and decide sort of where to take your reporting?
Sure, the same thing that you do. You just never stop talking to people. You gather as many voices from as many smart people as you can. You weight them by expertise. You weight them by their track record. And at the end of the day, you have to figure out, well, I think you're a little more right than this guy. That's where the preponderance of evidence is. But basically, you just never stop reporting.
What are you working on these days?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the biggest threats to the military today is not Al-Qaeda or insurgents. It's the budget problems. Mm-hmm. So I think over the next couple of months, those of us who watch national security will be very carefully measuring the impact of the debt debate and the budget cutbacks on what the military can do. And pretty soon, Chris, the American public is going to have to decide how much it wants to spend on what kind of national security, because the current strategy is not sustainable given the kind of budget cuts on the table.
Tom Shanker is Pentagon correspondent for The New York Times. Together with New York Times terrorism correspondent Eric Schmidt, he is the author of the new book Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Tom, it's been such an interesting hour. I really appreciate you making this time for us.
Well, again, it was a real pleasure. A great discussion. Chris, thank you so very much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.